Bobby Fischer amazed the world with his brilliance at the game of chess at an age when most children are learning how to read. But after reaching the top of the chess-playing world, his erratic behavior ultimately led to his being exiled from the United States. St. John's University professor Frank Brady, who may be the person most knowledgeable about Fischer's life and career, has written a book called Endgame, Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness. It's published by Crown, and it is my pleasure to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, this is your second book on Bobby Fischer. You wrote one in 1960 or so called Bobby Fischer, Profile of a Prodigy.
Yes.
Was he already exhibiting some of the troubling behaviors that came to dominate
his
later life?
No, not really when I wrote that. The first edition of that book, I sort of knew because I was a chess player and I knew Bobby and I had played him and so forth, that he was eventually going to become world champion. I had never written a book before. I went to a publishing house and said, I'd like to write the biography of Bobby Fischer. I know he's going to become world champion. They gave me a minuscule advance to go ahead and
he
do it.
He was barely in his 20s at the time.
In his teens, yeah. Oh. He was in his teens.
And what did he think of the book?
Well, there was a problem in the book in that I mentioned that he was Jewish.
And why did that disturb him? I think everybody assumed he was Jewish. He grew up in a Jewish neighborhood.
His mother was Jewish. His father, the patrimony is a little in doubt, but either one of two men were his father, and both of them were Jewish. He did have a bar mitzvah, although he never had a bris. He claimed that he wasn't Jewish, and his argument was, well, why do I have to be Jewish because my mother is Jewish? It's like saying, if my mother was a Republican, why couldn't I be a Democrat? And he had a sort of a point to it.
Except that if it really upset him so much, I mean, there are, you know, it's one thing to say I was born Jewish, but I choose not to practice the religion. And that's the same thing as I was born Republican. I choose not to stay in that party.
No, the most I ever got out of him is him saying I'm half Jewish, meaning that he knew that his mother was Jewish.
Do you think that it was partly because his mother was such a problematic person for him and for others? Wasn't she homeless when she gave birth to him?
She was homeless. They lived in a hospice. Later on, they lived in a trailer. But, you know, one of the misconceptions of Mrs. Fischer, and I think I dispel this in the book, I knew her. She was as bright as a penny, by the way, highly educated.
Did she play chess?
She did not play chess. She was hopeless as a chess player, as Bobby said, but she was very, very bright. She had not only an MD, but a PhD eventually, she later on in life. But she was not such a bad woman, and it was really a loving relationship. Did they fight? Of course they fought, as most people, as when you're a teenager, fight.
I just wonder whether some of the things he did weren't in reaction to her, because he became politically conservative as well. The FBI had taps on Regina Fischer's phone and suspected her of being a Soviet spy beginning in 1942.
Yes.
Did they have reason to be suspicious?
Well, she had spent 6 years in Moscow studying for a medical degree. She never got it. She was very, very left-leaning. She was sort of almost like a professional protester. So at that time in the 40s and certainly in the 50s, the FBI was investigating anybody. If you wore a red tie, they'd investigate you. You know what I mean? So she was under surveillance. Their phones were tapped. They went through records. J. Edgar Hoover actually was spearheading the investigation of her, and they never really found anything.
So how did Bobby fall in love with the game of chess if his mother didn't play it? His sister didn't play it either.
No, but his sister is the one who taught him the rules. She bought a little chess set for a dollar in a candy store, and they worked out the moves. And it's possible, I never asked him this question, and he might not have remembered, he may have won the very first game he ever played against his sister. She didn't take to it. He liked doing Japanese puzzles. He liked doing mazes. His mother would buy him book upon book of mazes, and he would work them through. He loved concentrating on that, figuring out things, how they came together, the patterns.
And did he play Go as well?
He never played Go. But, you know, later on, when he was about 15 or 16, someone gave him a Monopoly set and said, let's play Monopoly. And he took out the rules and he said, before I play, I have to understand. And he spent about 2 hours reading those rules until he had it down perfectly. Then he played.
And one, I suspect.
Yeah.
Didn't his devotion to the game of chess worry his mother? Why,
yes.
Why did it bother her?
Well, she wanted him to be broader, and she wanted him. At that point, there was nobody, well, maybe one person in the United States who could make a living playing chess. She was worried about his future. She wanted him to go to college. He had an astronomical IQ of 180, and she wanted him to get involved in other things, you know, a good Jewish mother.
And he was reading all these books about chess and little
else. He was. And, you know—
But he had to read some of them in other languages, so—
He learned the other languages, and since his mother was a polymath, she knew six languages fluently, and she got by on Yiddish. She taught him a lot, and he worked with her. At one point, he failed a Spanish exam when he went to Erasmus High. From that point, I mean, that was an absolute violation of the Fisher family code. You don't fail a language exam. And from there on in, for a period of time, she spoke to him in Spanish.
But he had a hard time losing or failing anyway. After losing games even against older and more skilled opponents, he would burst into tears.
Yes.
So he was that competitive?
Absolutely. And he cried. He not only cried as a child, but he cried even when he played in the candidates tournament against Mikhail Tal. I mean, he was older then. And he burst into tears. So he took the game really seriously.
What about his opponents? Did they take him seriously? He was small for his age when he was growing up.
Yes, that was. I remember him coming and playing in a tournament down at Asbury Park on the boardwalk there. I didn't talk to him, but it was one of the first times I ever saw him. And he was about 10, but he looked like he was about 6. He was very tiny at that time. And, of course, it was a novelty, so people sat around him and watched him play. But eventually he sprouted up to 6'2" as he got older. But, he was tiny at the beginning.
And he became a chess master at the age of 13.
13. He became an international grandmaster.
What does that mean?
Well, that's the top title. You can't get any
higher. No, but what do you have to do to get those titles?
You have to play through a series of tournaments, and you have to win, and you have to establish a rating. And once you get that title, it's a lifetime title, and he became the youngest international grandmaster in the world in the history of the game.
He was also playing blindfold chess at 13 with Jack Collins, who was one of the greatest teachers of chess. I have enough trouble with chess just when I can see all of the pieces.
Well, you know, even among chess players, not many people can do it. It seems almost mystical. How do you play a game of chess without seeing the board? But he was so absorbed in the game and so familiar with the 64 squares, you could tell him, you could say, what color is the square third up, fourth over the side? And he'd say, black or white. He would know immediately. He had a picture of the board in his mind and with all the pieces. So it was fairly easy for him.
Well, he claimed that Collins didn't teach him anything.
I know, and that was very rude and sad for him to say that, because I sat in a number of times where Jack was not a regular teacher in the sense of the word. He was very Socratic. He would set up a position and he'd say, Bobby, what do you think of this? Well, why is this move better than the other move? And there was teaching going on. And also when Bobby met Jack Collins, he was just barely a master. Jack Collins was among the top 50 players in the country. He was the author of Modern Chess Openings, which is the Bible of chess. And just playing Collins helped him a great deal.
Well, that's true of anybody. You play with somebody of great skills, and if you have the ability, you develop great skills
yourself.
Then
what happened to me? How come I didn't get any better? I played him a lot of games.
Well, and then there's Bobby Fischer and Boris Spassky and sure. Some of the other great ones. Frank Brady's – anyway, Bobby Fischer didn't write any books. Frank Brady has written Endgame, Bobby Fischer's remarkable rise and fall from America's brightest prodigy to the edge of madness. It's published by Crown. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. His competitive nature compelled him to want to play against the best chess players in the world. In the 50s, it was Europeans, mostly Russians, who were the best chess players in the world. Did they just have better programs?
Well, the point was that in the Soviet Union, chess was the national pastime. Chess players, grandmasters, were treated royally. They were given a salary. They were given homes in the country. They were given trainers. They didn't have to work. They were given money to go to international tournaments. There was one tournament in the Soviet Union where 700,000 players competed. Everybody in the Soviet Union knew how to play chess and played well. Bobby received none of that. There was no government support. There still is no government support.
How did the Russians treat Bobby when he showed up?
Well, at first they thought he was the Russian word, a novinka, a novelty. And, you know, yeah, he was this kid who was had talent, but he wasn't among the rarefied group. And he, when he arrived in Russia, in Moscow in 1958, he wanted to play Botvinnik, the world's champion, and he wanted to play the top players, and they weren't going to play him.
He was still a teenager.
Sure he was.
But a year before, he passed up the opportunity to play in the Hastings Christmas Congress in England in favor of the Lessing J. Rosenwald tournament in the United States. Why would he choose the lesser tournament?
Because the Lessing J. Rosenwald tournament was the qualifier to play in the zonal tournament, which would lead to the interzonal tournament, which would lead to a shot at the world's championship. If he played in the Hastings tournament, he wouldn't have that opportunity. It was a very difficult decision for him, by the way.
As I said earlier, you're credited with being the person who knows most about Bobby Fischer. But you say you played with him occasionally. How well did you know him, and when he started going through the changes in his life, did you remain in touch with him?
On and off. The answer to the first question is I knew him quite well. I lived in the village. He would come to my apartment. If my wife was busy that evening, Bobby and I would go out to dinner. Then we'd go to a chess club and play chess. We would play speed chess. Don't ask me who won. Of course he won. Almost all the time. And I got to know him quite well. And we went to dinner parties together. We traveled together. He was a friend. He was absolutely a friend. When he started going outre, let's say, if one can use that term.
To the edge of madness.
Yeah, I say
some
to the
edge.
Some
people might say he went kind of crazy.
Yeah. Well, I don't use that word. And I say in terms of him, but what I do say is that he was paranoid, and he, as most of us are in some ways, maybe slightly, he was definitely a disturbed person, neurotic, but he didn't have hallucinations. He didn't have delusions. And so, except where they impacted his paranoia.
Well, a lot of people have looked into the whole matter of genius and madness, but there are a fair number of geniuses who are very stable people.
True.
But what is it about somebody like Bobby Fischer that makes him so good at chess and other people with the same IQ not good at all?
Well, first of all, he had a tremendously competitive spirit. Even when he swam, he loved to swim, and in high school and stuff, he would dive into the pool. He'd be in the water before everybody else was. He had to win. When he went to Grossinger's as a young man up in the Catskills, he'd play tennis. He'd beat everybody except the tennis pro. He had to win. He had to win in arguments with you as well. He was always on the attack. So the competitive spirit helped. His devotion to the game and his study of the game, he was the greatest student of the game. And there's never been anyone who knew the game as well as he.
And you also have to have the ability, if you're a chess player, to project fairly far into the future. That's what makes computers so good at playing chess, because they can figure out all the possibilities.
Absolutely.
I know I'm so bad at it that a good chess player, once asked me if I thought I'd do better at losing chess, and of course I couldn't lose. It's the only time I ever won a chess.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, yes, he did have strategic planning. I mean, he could see, I think there are certain games that I've analyzed of Bobby's where he could see 20 to 25 moves ahead. Most people can see one or two moves ahead.
Now, you say he was competitive. He was distracted and annoyed by Michal Tal during their matches. He was so bothered that, didn't he threaten secretly to murder him?
Yes, he certainly did.
So was that a sign that things were changing, or was that just
He felt that this was the opportunity to play the world's championship, and that Tal was a very difficult player to play with in terms of his comportment at the board. He was always standing up, sitting down. He smoked an entire pack of cigarettes in the game. He would grimace, he would stare, he would laugh, he would go and talk to other players, and it was disturbing Bobby, and he felt that that was the reason that he lost the games. Now, it could have been sour grapes, but I don't think so. I think he really was disturbed by Tal's comportment. And so, therefore, he literally thought about it. Now, was this just a kid in braggadocio? But, you know, maybe I should sneak into his hotel room and put poison in his water.
Of course, he was still learning how to be a great chess player.
Yes, he was.
He was still a teenager, although he had played this remarkable game in 1956 when he was how old?
He was 13.
Against Donald Byrne. Yeah. Some people call it the game of the century.
That was some game, I am telling you. He looked so deeply into it, and when it happened, people just couldn't believe it. The game was printed all over the world, and that established Bobby as a world figure, really. It was a brilliant game. It brings tears to your eyes.
And then in 1964, he was 20 years old, he achieved a perfect score of 11 wins, no losses, and no draws. Now, almost every chess player plays for draws.
Absolutely. I was the arbiter of that tournament, and I watched it, and it was like him throwing a no-hitter in the World Series. I was afraid to say anything. Is he going to – because he kept winning and winning and winning and winning. And at the very end, it looked like the last game he may either lose or draw it, but he won that as well. It had never been done before. It hasn't been done since. It may never be done again.
But as his fame was increasing, he seemed to be getting paranoid. In what way?
He thought that people were cheating him. He thought that if they offered him $50,000 to play in a tournament, that maybe there was $75,000. He resented the...
Because he was a Brooklyn boy?
He was poor. Mm-hmm. He was poor, and he was trying not... He didn't want anybody to make any money off of him. And the American chess establishment wasn't helping him in any way. I mean, I helped him to some extent.
But on the other hand, he did have his standards. The New York master, Asa Hoffman, once said that if someone, I'm quoting, if someone was willing to pay $50 for a Bobby Fischer autograph and you're going to make $5 for introducing the autograph secret to him, Fischer would want the $5 too, or else he was willing to forfeit the $50.
Yeah. Well, I don't necessarily know that you would call that a standard, but that was his idea. No one's going to make a nickel off of me or my name. I want it all, and you cannot just take it.
My guest is Frank Brady, who's written a book called Endgame, Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness. It's published by Crown. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Frank Brady, whose latest book is Endgame, Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness. It's published by Crown. His 1972 match against Boris Spassky was seen as a metaphor for the Cold War. How much of an impact did it have on chess in this country?
It had an enormous impact. People who didn't know the game learned it. People who just peripherally knew it joined the U.S. Chess Federation. Chess clubs, membership soared. There was a tremendous interest in the game. Front page news in the New York Times all the time.
And television coverage as well.
Television coverage. They interrupted the Democratic National Convention because people said they wanted more information about the chess match. I mean, I guess it was WNET received so many calls of complaint that, I mean, people really got involved in chess.
So how did he handle the fame that came after winning the match?
He did not handle it well. He What happened was he received about $10 million in offers of sponsorship of products and appearance fees at tournaments and entry fees and so forth. He snubbed them all.
But you said that he needed all the money he could get.
He needed all the money, but he didn't take it. He also began to despise the media. He had it. There was an article, actually, way back in 1961 in Harper's Magazine that really vilified him in many ways, showed him as, you know, a very coarse and repugnant kind of kid, misogynistic, homophobic, uneducated, and so forth.
But wasn't that true?
No, it wasn't. Maybe partially true in some of the things. But he hated it. And from that moment on, he hated the media. And he did not want to be interviewed. He was like a J.D. Salinger or a Greta Garbo. He wanted to be left alone. Leave me alone. Let me go off to Los Angeles and be by myself. I've won the world's championship. I've done what I wanted to do. That was my goal. I've accomplished it. Now I want to be alone.
So he didn't want to keep on being the World Chess Federation champion?
But only on his own standards and merits. So when the 1975 match against Karpov was organized, he wanted a certain amount of money, and he wanted 139 different things. And the World Chess Federation was willing to give him 138. And he said, no, the heck with the match. I'm not doing it. That was a tremendous amount of money.
So he obviously also was self-defeating on some level.
And to that extent. And I think he really kicked himself in the rear end for a number of years because he didn't take that money and then he had to live in almost abject poverty.
On the other hand, beginning in the 1970s, he began giving a tithe, 10% of his earnings to the Worldwide Church of God. So that was a church that was kind of anti-Semitic, wasn't it?
It was not anti-Semitic. It was an apocalyptic religion. It was one might call it a cult. It started as a radio ministry. Bobby used to always listen to radio, by the way, all the time. He was a big radio listener, and that's how he found it. And he got involved in it, but he wasn't in it that very long, maybe 3 years, and then he became disillusioned with the leaders of it.
But then in 1973, he began reading anti-Semitic literature. That's why I thought of that. There must have been some link here. He was reading the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and things like that. What attracted him to books like those? Sounds almost like self-hatred.
Well, he was a self-hating Jew, if you would. And he became a self-hating Jew. And he wanted to divorce himself from Judaism. He got a copy of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and he bought into it. And as we all know, it's a work of fiction, but he bought it.
And pretty outrageous.
It's absolutely outrageous.
So to believe it, you have to go a long way to believe some of the claims of that. And everybody knows the circumstances that led to its being forged by the Tsarist secret police. So did he not read about that?
Perhaps not, but even today there are people that believe it. So,
if you want to believe something, you'll believe
sure,
it.
Sure.
Going back to that, losing his title because he had all those conditions. What were some of the conditions he had that the World Chess Federation couldn't abide by?
Well, he wanted certain lighting. He wanted a certain money. He wanted if the match ended up as a 10-10, that he would retain the championship. He saw his game just like a concert pianist on the stage of Carnegie Hall. He wanted no noise. He wanted proper lighting. He wanted everything to be perfect. And actually, he got it. Those things were given to him. And indeed, he elevated the game of chess for that reason.
But then he made too many demands. What were the demands that they couldn't accept?
They could not accept this 9-9 tie. If it came to 9-9, that he would retain the championship.
Well, I can understand that. But sure. Is it even likely that it would have ended that way? He was at the top of his game.
Oh, good point. It was a matter of principle to him. And I think he would have absolutely demolished Karpov in that match. But it was not to be.
And then some other things. He had all the fillings in his teeth removed because he was concerned about the mercury?
Yes, and, you know, other people have
said
that.
Yeah, he wasn't alone in doing that.
Wasn't alone, and one of the misconceptions is that he thought that he was being radio signals were coming from the Soviet Union, they could pick up his thoughts. That's all spurious. That's sensationalized. He did it for health reasons. He believed that mercury in your mouth is bad for you.
But had his politics changed when he first went to the Soviet Union? People were critical of people who traveled there, musicians and the like. He seemed to ignore all of that.
I'm not quite sure I understand the question, but
had he moved to the right now, was he suddenly more suspicious of the Soviet Union?
He had become suspicious of the Soviet Union when he was 15 years old and he went to Moscow for the first and only time, and thought he should have been treated like Van Cliburn with more respect.
Well, Van Cliburn wasn't treated with respect until he won the competition.
He won the Tchaikovsky competition. But then he was
recently we spoke to Byron Janis, the great pianist, who ran into similar problems. They just thought he was some American who couldn't play piano well. And then, of course, he proved them wrong by playing wonderfully.
Yeah.
And Bobby Fischer was probably the greatest chess player in the world at the time.
Bobby also believed, and it turned out to be truth, and this has come out in KGB files, that indeed the Russians were sort of ganging up on him in tournaments. They would agree to short draws, gave them more time to relax. And they were ganging up on him.
But then he started being critical of the United States. In 1975, he refused to pay any income tax?
That is right.
And why? What was his reasoning behind that?
His reasoning behind that is that he lost a big case, like a $100 million lawsuit that he brought against Time Life Incorporated because of a violation of a contract. A reporter was doing articles in Life magazine. He did allow that. And the contract said that no book would be written about him. And 2 years later, the reporter wrote a book about him. And so he sued for violation of contract. But he handled the suit himself. And so, you know, he's writing on a yellow pad or something and handing that as the brief to the court. And so they threw the case out of court. And he said, I don't believe in the jurisprudence system of the country anymore. I don't believe in the country anymore. I'm not going to pay any more taxes. And he didn't.
So he wouldn't he wouldn't hire a lawyer. Just thought he would be the best lawyer.
Well, he always thought he was the best in everything he did.
How is he making a living? So far we've been describing him turning down all opportunities to earn any money.
Well, he wasn't really making that much of a living. He did write two books, and he was making about $6,000 a year in royalties on those books and his mother's Social Security checks. And that's what he lived on for 20 years.
But in the 90s, fearing for his life, he refused interviews and photographs, but he began traveling with bodyguards. They cost money, don't they?
Yeah, well, that was after he won the $3.5 million in Montenegro. He didn't have the bodyguards before that.
Now, how did he come to win all that money in Montenegro?
There was a match, a $5 million match. There was a young girl who he had fallen in love with. 17 years old, he realized that the only way, when she reached 18, he wanted to marry her. The only way to marry her was to have some money. And so he agreed finally to come out of retirement after 20 years and play another match with Spassky for $5 million, $3.5 million to the winner, $1.5 million to the loser. He won the match, but it was against the United States sanctions against Serbia because of the Kosovo War. And a warrant was issued for his arrest. He was indicted, and he became a sort of man without a country at that point.
He was threatened with thousands of dollars in fines and 10 years in prison if he played the match.
Yes, and he spat on the letter from the U.S. Treasury Department in front of the world's press, in front of the television cameras. This really irritated the government, of course.
He started wearing a heavy leather coat because he was afraid of knife attacks?
Yes. He certainly was, and it's possible, I can't prove this, but I think he also wore a bulletproof vest.
Now, we used the word paranoia before. Is this paranoid, or were there any serious threats on his life?
Even paranoids have enemies, and he thought that because of his anti-Semitic statements, that the Mossad may be after him because he stole the championship 20 years before from the Soviet Union, that the Soviets may be after him, and he was afraid America was after him for violating the sanctions, and so this was the reason he was operating the way he was.
On the one hand, he wanted to live a more reclusive life. On the other hand, he did all sorts of things to call attention to himself, like his comments after the 9/11 attacks.
That was so atrocious. I felt it was hideous.
Where was he living at the time?
He was living in between Tokyo and Manila, back and forth, 3 months in Tokyo, 3 months in Manila.
And why those two countries? Did the Japanese appreciate what he was doing?
No, he had a woman in both, like the captain's paradise, he had a woman in both situations. And you could only stay as a tourist in the country for 3 months. So, you know, one day before the 3 months was up, he'd fly to Manila and then he'd do the same thing.
Did these women know that there was the other woman?
I don't know. I do not know that. They probably did. He was very open about talking about himself to certain people. But, you know, he lived that way for a number of years.
And it's one thing to be angry with the United States because you lost a court case. Another thing to hate it so much that what did he say after the 9/11 attack?
He said, "I applaud the act," and he was glad that the United States was finally getting its own, and that the United States was an outlaw country, that it really belonged to the Native Americans, and that's who should be running the country.
How old was he when he died?
He was 64, the exact number of squares on a chessboard, but that irony should not be pushed too far.
And what was the cause of death?
Kidney failure, adrenaline failure.
Because 64 is rather young.
It certainly is, and no one knows why his kidneys failed, but he refused dialysis. He was told that if he didn't accept it, he might only have 3 months to live, and he did not accept it, and he died in Iceland.
He also, some people suggested that it was a suicide. Do you think?
It's an interesting theory, and yes, it's possible. I mean, since he was told in no uncertain terms that he wouldn't live if he didn't get dialysis, even if it was not conscious suicide, it certainly might have been unconscious suicide.
He did live an interesting life when he was in exile. Didn't he meet a member of the Italian mafia in Italy after he'd been exiled from the United States?
He did. He said he wanted to study the structure of the mafia family, whether that's true or not, but he did go to Italy to meet a mafioso.
And did he continue playing chess?
No. He just gave
it up altogether after it had been so important in his life?
He invented another form of chess, a variation of chess called Fischer-Random, and no one really is taking that seriously. I mean, none of the chess world is taking it seriously.
Is it a good game, do you think?
It's okay. What it does is all of the study that one has done in openings and endgames and strategies go out the window because this is a different way of playing. But no, he never really played chess again.
And he spoke to the mafia because he had developed this interest in the underworld?
Yes.
Was he writing a book?
He was writing a book. He thought that Kasparov and Karpov, their matches were fixed, and he was going to prove that. And he made many tapes and wrote many, many notebooks filled with proof, what he considered proof.
It would have been hard for him to find a publisher in the United States. So how do you think he'll be remembered in the long run, for his achievements or for his terrible decline?
Well, within the chess world, he will be remembered for his achievements.
His games are still studied?
His games are still studied. They're still quoted. He was a brilliant player. He was the Mozart of chess. He was the greatest chess player that ever lived. In terms of the public, non-chess playing public, he's probably going to be known for his outrageous remarks.
Frank Brady will be speaking and signing books on Wednesday, February 16th at 7 p.m. at the Barnes & Noble store in Fresh Meadows, Queens. That's at 176-60 Union Turnpike. The book Endgame, Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness. It is published by Crown. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.